Tonight on Standing Room Only, the League of Women Voters legislative update.
Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
On January 6th, the League of Women Voters of Bloomington Monroe County gathered with local representatives for an update on legislative action.
On behalf of the League of Women Voters of Bloomington Monroe County, I'd like to welcome you to the first of our 2018 series of legislative updates. My name is Kate Cruikshank, and I will be moderating the session. This morning, our local legislators will report on the current session of the Indiana General Assembly, and then we will welcome questions from the audience. I've asked them to limit their remarks to about 10 minutes each, which they may or may not use all of. But just to give us an orientation, I've suggested that we're interested in the committees they're serving on, the legislation that they have authored or are co-sponsored, and just priorities that they each have for the session. With us this morning we have, and I'm delighted we have, as many as we have, we may have Bob Heaton on his way over from Terre Haute. He was going to try to make it. We do have Peggy Mayfield representing the 60th House District, Matt Pierce representing the 61st House District, Jeff Ellington representing the 62nd House District, and we have walking through the door at this very moment, Mark Stoops, representing the 40th Senate District. I received notice that both Chris May and Eric Cook would not be able to attend.
Peggy Mayfield, I cover parts of Monroe County down basically the eastern side of the county and about two-thirds of Morgan County. Came into the General Assembly in 2012, so I'm beginning my sixth year. I feel like a combination of a newcomer and a veteran all at the same time because we're going through a lot of, since 2007, 70 members of the House, that's 100 people, have changed. So, yeah, when we talk about a lot of term limits and attrition, we have a significant amount of turnover within the House. The committees I serve on are Public Policy, Ways and Means, and the House Insurance Committee. I also serve as Assistant Majority Floor Leader, and I guess that's enough to keep me busy there. In private life, we have an insurance agency in Mooresville, and we live up in the Martinsville area. The bills, I guess, that I wanted to talk about a little bit, last year I only had one bill pass, but it was a bill I worked 5 years on, was to protect our reserve law enforcement officers, and it finally passed last year with only a single no vote between both chambers. So now that any reserve officer who is injured in the line of duty would be covered for their medical bills, which before there was no guarantee that they would be covered. So they will be covered for their medical bills, and since most of these guys work a regular job outside of their law enforcement opportunity, they would also get a minimum stipend of sorts for the time that they are off work if they cannot go back to their regular job. So that finally went through last year. There was another bill I was working on that actually didn't ever have to have a hearing because, you know, sometimes when people come to you and say, this needs to be fixed, I got a whole list in this phone as I walk through the aisles of Walmart and Kroger where people stop me and say, I got an idea. Great, I write it down. When I start investigating it, maybe it doesn't need to be legislation. Maybe it just needs to be a change in the rule of whatever agency oversees that. So last year I introduced a bill because I couldn't get an agency to move on an issue, so I introduced a bill and suddenly everyone came to the table and they changed the rule to fit what I was trying to fix legislatively within the rulemaking process, which also means that if it should ever need to be changed again, they can do it much quicker than legislation. So legislation's kind of a stranglehold on things sometimes. So it's not always the appropriate fix for a problem. So there's, you know, you get one bill passed, you get one that you say is passed, but it never actually went through the legislative process. This year, we are limited to 5 bills in the House in a short session. And There's a couple things that I'm still working on. Most of these things come up year after year as you continue working on support or working on the committee chairman to give a hearing. And some things have to be passed. Like, I'm carrying a bill for Department of Child Services Child Support Division. I don't want to get into that other DCS issue just yet. Because there's federal changes in how child support is handled, we have to adopt those rules into state law. So this is really a department bill. I let them work out the details, what has to be changed, and then I carry it through the process. The other ones I'm working on, I worked on last year, and I'm trying to continue this year again, is a tax credit for hiring ex-offenders, ex-felons after they are out. As many people know, our recidivism rate hovers in the mid-30s, and people don't have the opportunity to expunge their record for at least 5 years, sometimes eight or maybe longer. But the recidivism typically happens within the first 18 months to 3 years. So I was talking to a couple of employers who do make it a practice to hire ex-offenders and said, what will it take to incentivize a company that doesn't incorporate this as their mission? What kind of incentive would it take for them to take a chance on an ex-offender? And the two things they came back with was a little financial incentive, which would be a tax credit, and the other was immunity from civil liability when you get named in a lawsuit because you should have known better than to hire an offender. Well, that may have nothing to do with the offense that they committed, but as you know, in our litigious society, they name everybody they can, and then they see who can get left holding the bag. So the employers want a little bit of sureness, confidence that they're not going to get dragged into a suit because one of their employees has done something, and then they get sued in the process. So we're trying to do that. It would allow for, it would cap the tax credits for the state at, I think, $2.5 million, so that it only would allow about 800 ex-offenders to be hired, which, that's a lot of ex-offenders, and they have to work for an entire year to qualify. So if someone's going to stay with you for a year, it's a good indication that they're going to remain a good employee, you know, and be a contributing member of society. Their tax credit would somewhat be offset by the income tax that they will now be paying. They will not be taking part in a lot of our social programs, and they're a contributing member of society. So I'm trying to work. This is a bipartisan thing. Actually, only parts of this bill are original to me. Representative Robin Shackelford from Indianapolis has carried a very similar bill for several years, and we're going to try and work in a bipartisan manner to continue moving this forward. The other one that might be of interest, it has to do with what has happened in Monroe County, but this is an issue that is statewide, and that is the formation or dissolving of fire territories. And since it hasn't been used a lot throughout the state, and so no one's ever really found out where the rough edges are, where the bumps are, where we need to smooth out some of this process. And so I'm trying to address that, because I think that as townships and municipalities and counties get more and more, I won't say strapped for cash, but they're looking for more efficient means to deliver services, they're going to need a smoother process to establish or dissolve fire territories, or who gets in and when they get in and how they get out and what do they take with them. All of those things have never been addressed in statute before. So now that people are starting to use it more and more, I'm trying to address that process to so they know what they're getting into or when they or how they get out of it. Some of the priorities, I know that everybody else is going to want to talk about this. DCS, I'm just going to mention, everybody wants to address this. I've got a judge in my county who is known for taking on DCS. I've got some, we have a systemic problem in DCS that we need to identify. There are so many issues that could be contributing to the problem. We have twice as many kids in our system as our surrounding states, almost three times as many as Kentucky. Throwing money at it, if the money was solving the problem, would be a great thing. But there are so many aspects to this that I don't think, we want to make sure that whatever money we are spending there is solving the problem. And so we really have to take a top-down look at every aspect, every policy, every procedure, every training issue to do that. And the deeper we dig, I think the more we find. And so I think that it is a wise thing. I wish we could act upon this quicker, but I think we need all the facts. We need a deeper investigation. I think it's good that it's a third party that's doing it, so that you know they can, one, it's a company that does this as their business, and they can bring a unbiased report to us so that we can look at what the problems are, how they need to be fixed, and how they need to be funded. Because throwing money at it, and I'm not saying we're not, throwing money at it is not a good thing. We have invested more than $600 million in the last few years. We've added 1,000 caseworkers. That's 75% increase over what we had. So we're up to about 2,400 caseworkers. We're not seeing an impact. So we have to kind of step back and analyze, if we're doing all this, where are we still falling short, and how can we rearrange this, and how can we address it? So I look forward to seeing that. I don't know, maybe I don't look forward to seeing that, but it's something that we have to address. But we got to have the data before we make the changes. I can't just change things, you know, for the sake of changing things to make you feel good like you did it.
I'll let Jeff go ahead. Jeff, thank you.
So I represent District 62, which takes care of southwest portions of Monroe County, 90% of Greene County, and the top half of Martin and Davies County. Very rural on the west side of my district. I spent two terms locally as a county councilman. Also during that term, those terms, I was a plan commission president for 2 years, sat on the plan commission for 4 years. I also was on the solid waste district boards, where I learned a lot about recycling materials and in use and what it cost us to, you know, not be efficient with our materials. I also was able to be appointed to the board of Center for Behavioral Health, now it's called Centerstone, with my connections with friends and relatives who's went through that system, and having the financial experience on the council. And at that point, it was an appointment that they had changed, and I was privileged to be there. As far as my home life, also I want to say that best to all Pat Haley's family. You know, we mourn with that loss. And before her, you know, was Jim Fielder, and I was fortunate enough to fill Jim Fielder's position as county recorder. And that was a really a fun job, where I really sat there and met people as they came in the door. So I sat personally on local government, which deals with a lot of local government codes and things that change for cities and towns and counties. Also sit on natural resources, and I've been appointed the vice chairman this session on that committee, which what that means is I spent a lot of time there already. But so when the chairman has the main bill for DNR or other issues, I'll run that meeting for him. Also sit on financial institutions, which deals with banking or anything in securities, as far as from allowing credit unions to purchase banks or vice versa. We made a change in the Indiana's law last year. You know, credit unions are a growing industry across the state. Also sit on the committee, a statutory cooperative effort between states and anything that would have jurisdictions that comes across state lines or comes across several county lines, such as pipelines, waterways, groundwater issues and who controls those or who owns those, interstate compacts between different states' borders. We had one meeting last year, and we generally don't have about one per year, but right now we're currently working with groundwater issues along southeast portions of Indiana around the Ohio River with Kentucky. There's a large aquifer there that comes over into Indiana, but the majority of it is in Kentucky. So we're trying to work out agreements with that so we don't end up in court over those water rights. For me, last year, I had some legislation I thought was really great. I had one of our first opiate bills the past year that had local input. It outlawed two products that were available on the internet, even though they were illegal across the nation. Indiana hadn't made that change yet, and we made those changes. That's kind of a groundwork for the opiate epidemic we have currently. Had also a bill that dealt with how boards are appointed, that it really kind of shined the light, you might say, on those appointments. Are you really from one party or the other, or are you just saying that so you can outweigh or overweight a committee or commission, which I think it's all about having that fair, equitable division amongst thinkers. Also had a bill that was absorbed into Bob Heaton's bill, Securities Division bill. We talked about that last session, where it protected investors here in Indiana. And so if someone made an investment, you made an investment with someone, they had a 4 or 5 year contract. At the end of that contract, if you finally figured out that your money was taken illegally and it's gone, the statute of limitations would kick in, and it's really hard to prove in court that there was intention there for theft or fraud. So what my bill does is if you find, and the prosecutor finds at a certain date and time that there was fraud involved, that restarts that statute of limitations, and it gives an additional 4 to 5 years for the prosecutor to get the evidence to bring someone to justice. And that right there, to me, was probably one of the biggest things I was able to have input on because it protects those individuals who retired, takes their 401k and want to invest it with a group, and then pretty soon they're broke. What I have coming up this session, originally I had a bill we was getting ready to file for an innkeeper's tax, which if the innkeeper's tax would have been moved from 5% to 8% to 10%, it would have covered the expenses for the new convention center. But the local officials chose not to support that ideal, and they chose the food and beverage tax. I didn't agree with it, but it was their decision. So that bill is now in the waste can. I have which I really like, is a telemarketing bill. I don't know if your phone's been ringing off the hook, and you pick up and you think it's your neighbor calling you or a friend calling you. I've had people call me and say, hey, you just call me. What did you want? And I'm like, no, I didn't call you. They have computer systems that click over, so if they're calling an 812 prefix or a 317, their computer program will kick up a phone number from that district, so it seems like it's a friendly call. So what my bill will do, it'll allow businesses to sign up for the Do Not Call list. Right now they are exempt, and I believe it costs businesses more money than we ever know about answering those empty phone calls. It also takes penalties, whether they're criminal or monetary, up the chain of ladder to the CEOs and the CFOs and the board members. And it doubles that fee from $5,000 to $10,000 if you're up in that upper scale of management. Also, it creates a study committee for the Attorney General's office that we need to figure out what can we do logistically, financially, how much personnel does the Attorney General's office need to help with this effort, what kind of equipment we need, and the budget. And it'll also entail cybersecurity, which also deals with computer fraud, and that's all going to be wrapped in one because that's happening to a lot of us here locally and across Indiana. Also have a building codes bill. Basically what that does is if you're a builder and you're building structures, whether it's residential or commercial, state has building codes set that are very important statewide. There are some municipalities and small, and I'm not talking about just Bloomington, there's other ones that add things in there that's not specifically in code. So what this does, it says that if it's important enough, it'll go to a state code and be adopted statewide. And so that's what my bill does. I also have an annexation bill, ties in with a couple other different things. One, it talks about waivers for remonstrance. So the contracts were set up initially with developers on property or maybe individual people on property, but those were individual contracts between municipalities that provide sewer or water. and that original owner. But what happened was those waivers did not get filed in the chain of title for your property. So two or three owners later don't know that there was a waiver that was signed. So it's not fair. You know, it's kind of like if you buy a home and all of a sudden somebody comes knocking on your door 10 years later and says, oh, by the way, I put a roof on 10 years ago and the previous owner didn't pay for it, you're liable. That's not fair. So my bill says that if it's not filed within 90 days, the chain of title, it's void. Some people will say, well, you know, that's a contract, you're disrupting a contract. Well, that contract was not written with that current property owner. And so I think that these individuals have a legal standing really to go to court and to throw those waivers out. So I'm trying to make that process a little easier. Public safety tax we deal with here locally and across the county. Public safety tax, depending upon when it was adopted, whether it was a CAGED or a COET, if it existed before that, there's two different avenues that you're put in if you do the public safety tax. One is it's based on population, divided down by townships, towns and cities, and local government. The other way is the county council, which controls the whole county, makes that budget. So mine will make that more fair, and it'll go to a county level to be divided down. So I appreciate the time, the opportunity to serve you. It's very important to hear what you have to say, and I will listen to you. Whether I agree with you or not, I got to listen to you because you have a different perspective on certain issues than I do or than anybody else. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Matt, you want to go ahead?
I represent District 61, which is most of the city of Bloomington, kind of the center of town here, pretty compact district. And I want to just go over the bills that I've introduced quickly and then some of the issues that I think will come up generally in the this session. This, by the way, is the short session, which means we have to be finished by March 14th. We don't have to pass a budget because that's a two-year budget we did last year. So it's kind of a quick in and quick out. You know, primary elections are looming in May and general elections in November, and so they've kind of set it up so you can get in and get out and go campaign, I guess. So one of the bills I've introduced, you might have read about in the paper, heard a little bit about in the news, is an end-of-life options bill, which is based on Oregon's Death with Dignity Law, which has been in place about 20 years. And it essentially allows people who are have terminal diseases and their prognosis is that they will pass away within 6 months, that if they're facing a very painful and difficult death, they would have the option to seek medication that would help them end their lives on their own terms, which I understand is a controversial issue, but I think it's one worth having a conversation about. And so that's the main reason why I introduced the bill, is I want to try to jumpstart discussion about that. And what I'm hoping is the public will get engaged and they'll talk to their legislators about what they think about the bill. And then that might give people a little bit more confidence to kind of have a hearing on the bill and begin to discuss the issue a little bit more earnestly than it's been the case. So that that is out there. The next bill, a little less weighty issue, auto parts when you get in a wreck. So right now, if you file a claim with your insurance company because you've had an accident, you have the right to insist that you get factory original parts for replacements. Oddly enough, I had a constituent contact me a couple years ago and tell me that they discovered that if the other driver is at fault that had an accident with you and you file a claim with that insurance company, you do not have the right to insist upon factory original parts, which I thought was just some kind of loophole in the law or some oversight or something, but at least the response of the insurance companies, maybe not so much. So what I'm trying to do is just unify it so that whether you're filing a claim against another driver's insurance company or with your own company, you would still have the right to insist on those factory original parts if you want them. And, you know, some people say, well, you should just file through your own company and they can subrogate that or kind of go after the other company to pay them back. But as you know, people are reluctant to do that because they feel their rates are going to go up if they file any kind of claim with their own company. So I'm hoping, and Jeff Ellington has joined me on that bill, so it's kind of a new experience for us to work together on something. So hopefully we'll have a happy ending there. We'll have to see. Another bill that I've introduced would address these issue of non-disclosure agreements and sexual harassment and sexual assault cases. You know, we've read a lot about situations where we're finding out that we've had kind of serial abusers who've been able to cover their tracks because they've been able to essentially do an out-of-court settlement with their victims and then put in that settlement a requirement that no one be allowed to talk about the incidents that happened. And we've seen in some instances that's allowed people to really continue their bad behavior. And so what my bill would do is say in the state of Indiana that you cannot have those non-disclosure agreements and settlements in those particular types of cases. And so we'll see if we can get some traction on that. There's some people who say, well, if you take away the non-disclosure agreement, what will happen is you won't get settlements, and then maybe the victims will not get compensated for the harm that was done to them. But I think that when you look at the greater good for society, the greater impact, even if you have a little bit of that, I think it's more important that people not be able to hide what they're doing. Because we saw the case with the gymnast and that doctor, that's just a classic example, and they're speaking out now and saying they were frustrated that they basically had this gag put on them not to be able to discuss what happened. So we'll see where that goes. And then finally, I've got a bill that will put in place in Indiana the internet privacy rules that were repealed by Congress. You might remember that the Obama administration's Federal Communications Commission at the very end of his term adopted privacy regulations that required people like Verizon, AT&T that provide you internet service that get you to affirmatively opt in to a process where if they wanted to use sensitive information about the websites you view when you use the internet, those types of things that they can keep track of you. People probably don't realize every time you get on your computer and go somewhere on the internet, there's a log kept to that by Comcast, whoever your provider is. So they have a huge amount of information about what people do on the internet. And I think that people would like to have that protection. So what my bill would say is that in the state of Indiana, those carriers have to essentially abide by those regulations that were repealed by Congress a couple months back. Okay, now for a quick rundown on some of the bills that I think we'll see. I'm hoping that redistricting issue will come up again. I know people are working hard on that. I'm skeptical that it'll really get any traction. But I've heard some rumors that, oddly enough, support might be growing in the Senate for it, which used to be kind of the stumbling block. People in the House leadership used to say they wanted to do something, but they've kind of gone cold on it. So I don't know if this is a thing where you just shift back and forth until people kind of get tired of what you're doing. But I think that's another issue where the people are really going to have to tell their legislators they want this done, because you are asking people to give up power and control with this system. And it's kind of a bipartisan thing. The Democrats redrew the maps in their favor when they had control. I'll fully admit that. That's the way it's worked. It doesn't mean it's right. And so I think that in order to have whoever's in power give up that advantage, the people are really going to have to demand it. So hopefully people will let their legislators know what they think of that. On the DCS oversight issue, you know, that's the troubling situation where we had the director of the Department of Child Services basically quit and write one of the most scathing letters I've ever seen, and essentially said that, you know, the way things are being operated now with the oversight she's getting from the governor's office, that children are very well going to die. And that's a pretty strong thing. So when that first came out, the governor's response was kind of nothing to see here, move along. And that didn't quite work out. So then he said he was going to hire this outside group, or is hiring an outside group, that will come in and kind of audit the system and examine what's happening and make recommendations on how to improve the system if that's necessary. And I think that is fine, but it has a political advantage of freezing the legislature, or allowing us to basically say in the legislature, well, we have to wait until that report comes in, which will come in after we're gone, and then we won't be able to do anything about it until January of next year. So this is one of these situations, I've said this before in other issues, I believe the General Assembly has an obligation to provide oversight of the executive branch and how our government operates. And so we ought to be having hearings. We should bring in the former director and ask her exactly what has frustrated you, what is happening. We should let the person the governor appointed to go over there and ride herd on DCS, ask him what he was trying to accomplish. Give people opportunity to ask hard questions on both sides and get the information to see what's actually happening, then determine if there's things we could do right now in this session of the legislature in order to fix the situation. But the legislature really does not have a good track record of oversight on the executive branch. So I suspect that what will happen is the legislature will do nothing until that report comes out. Maybe the governor will do some things himself in response to that. But the legislature really won't have a chance to weigh in until next January, if that's the case there. Another big issue, I think, will be expansion of opioid treatment and just trying to continue to attack that problem. And my goal is to make sure we keep addressing it as a public health issue. There's another proposal to increase a penalty on drug crimes, which happens every year. We feel like we have to have one tough-on-crime thing just to kind of protect ourselves, and I think that it ends up being self-defeating. It doesn't really work and actually causes more harm than good. CBD oil, I'm optimistic that we can make clear that that's legal, not just for use by kids with epilepsy, but anyone across the board who feels that medically they could benefit from it, so I'm going to work very hard on that. Another issue might come up is logging in the backcountry areas of Yellowwood and Morgan Monroe State Forest. I'm going to try to address the issue of tolling. I don't think the governor on his own with the rubber stamp from the budget committee, budget agency, should be able to toll roads, so I think the legislature should have to do that, so I'll see if I can do something there. We have another issue with whistleblower state employees who raise issues of unethical legal conduct. They're not protected according to recent decisions, so we need to do that, and my time is up.
You've been listening to the League of Women Voters Legislative Update on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to Matt Pierce, representative of the 61st House District, speak about the work he has completed and will continue this session. His update was third in a series of five local legislators. Now return to the show, with Representative Bob Heaton speaking about the work he has completed and will continue this session.
Okay, Bob, let's go ahead and finish the House. Is that all right, Mark? We can finish the House and then move over to the Senate. Bob?
Well, thank you, Kate. Appreciate it. My name is Bob Heaton. I represent House District 46. I just live south of Terre Haute. And you don't realize how bright that sun is until you drive into it for an hour. But glad to be here. My district consists of four counties, Vigo County, Clay County, most of Owen County, and two townships here on the west side of Monroe County, Bean Blossom, as well as Richland Townships. Been in the State House, this will be my eighth year, and recently I don't know if I was promoted or demoted. I'm with Peggy now on Ways and Means, and I'm not on Natural Resources now, but I'm on Ways and Means Committee as well as Financial Institutions and Insurance. Insurance is my background. I was on a bank board for 15, 16 years, so I guess that's why they put me on Financial Institutions. But as Representative Pierce mentioned, it is a short session, and we don't have to deal with the budget since we dealt with that last year, and as I've said to some of my colleagues, and they agree that hopefully this short session is a short session, but sometimes it can be long depending on the topics that we discuss. I filed three out of the four bills that I'm going to have. The one bill that I had last year dealt with in Terre Haute area, the Vigo County food and beverage tax, they're looking at building a convention center over there, and they're looking for additional revenue. And it didn't go anywhere last year, and so I brought it back, and we'll see where it goes. I know some of my colleagues, Representative Sharon Nagel from Attica, she needs some type of funding for the town of Attica, and she's presenting a bill for food and beverage and for the town of Attica. And I think Representative Dan Linder from Huntington, he's got one as well. But Bob Cherry, who represents Hancock County, Rich Greenfield, I think it is, he's got a uniform type of bill that will allow communities, counties throughout the state to enact their own type of food and beverage tax. And so I think that's where it's going to, whether it's this year or next year, we'll see. But I'm finding out from other of my colleagues that there are needs out there. And who am I to say somebody in over in Wayne County and in Richmond what their needs are or not, but to allow the locals to decide on doing that. But so I did bring that back. Two and a half months ago or so, I got a call from Secretary of State Connie Lawson, and she wanted me to carry another bill again for her that pertained to security matters and the registration of securities. That's going to be House Bill 1135, and it's somewhat of a cleanup bill dealing with definitions and so forth, but I'm going to be working with her on that. Also, the last few years, we've had a bill that dealt with cyclists, you know, giving them 3 feet and riding their bikes along the, whether it's a street or a road or not an interstate, of course, but give them a 3-foot clearance so he or she can be somewhat protected, or at least have a law that says to the motorists that you gotta give them some space. The state of Illinois has that. I think North Carolina has a law that gives them 2 feet of clearance, but it's been filed in the General Assembly for a few years. I think a couple years ago, Representative Ed Delaney had a bill that pertained to that. Didn't go anywhere, but I've got a constituent over in Owen County who wanted me to look into that and carry a bill, and so that's what I'm doing. And we'll see. Hopefully that will go somewhere, but I'm not quite sure yet, but we'll see how that goes. And also, I wanted to make note that I filed a bill on Thursday. It's House Bill 1257, and this bill I worked with a guy named Steve Cook. He's president and CEO of Indiana Association of Rehabilitation Facilities, and Steve and his staff, as well as his lobbyists that he works with, I worked on this bill with them. And it's it deals with the, and I'll just go ahead and read some of my notes here that pertains to that, but it says the state use program, also called the Ability Indiana program, is a law that requires the state to produce and purchase, or allows the state to purchase products and services from employment centers around the state that employment individuals with disabilities. And Stone Belt is one of those employment centers. And I know out at Stone Belt, I toured with Leslie Green. I don't know if Leslie's here or not, but I was out there a couple months ago and toured her facility, and what a great job they do. But what Stone Belt does, they make leather belts and I think coasters. And so what one thing this bill will do will promote those products and throughout the state and for purchase. And but there are over 16 people with disabilities that are employed around the state to do work like what Stone Belt does. And the rest areas that we have, those people are employed. Those people that with disabilities that do janitorial work. So this is something that will help continue that employment opportunities for those people. This was passed 42 years ago in the General Assembly back in 1976, but this bill will more or less update some of the some of those previous laws that was passed 42 years ago, but also some of the changes that the bill makes. It's updating the definition of a person with a disability to match the federal definition, and it requires the state procurement agency, the Department of Administration, to send out the catalog of available products and services annually to all state agencies to know what products are available for purchase. So I've got bipartisan support with everybody on both sides of the aisle, I believe, on this. I've got Representative Greg Porter on the bill with me, as well as a couple other individuals. So I'm looking forward to having that bill presented here shortly in committee. So appreciate everybody here today, and look forward to the dialogue that we're going to have. So thank you.
Thank you, Bob. I just want to check one thing. Peggy, I think you were the one who said that in the House, people are allowed to file 5 bills in the short session. Is that right? So while all this is going on in the House, we're now going to find out from Mark Stoops what's going on in the Senate. And Mark, how many are senators allowed to file in the short session? If you could just tell us that as well.
Well, with the wisdom of tradition, it's 10. And I have 10 bills filed. My name is Mark Stoops, Indiana Senate District 40, which is most of Monroe County, Bloomington, Indiana University, except for the townships that border Lawrence County in the south. And like Representative Mayfield, this is my 6th session. And I feel a little more comfortable going into this session knowing what to expect from the supermajority in the legislature. I have a better handle on what this governor, current governor, is willing to do and not willing to do. I'm on a number of committees, so I will continue on as ranking minority member of the Environmental Committee in the Senate. I'm ranking minority member on tax and fiscal, and ranking minority member on utilities, as well as a member of the Education Committee, the Health Committee, and Commerce and Technology. So as you can see in the Senate, Democrats are spread a little thin. And so it's a lot to handle, and it's important on these committees to make sure that I'm aware and the other members of the Senate Democratic Caucus are aware of what's moving. It's usually the committees where you first get your heads up on what's going to be happening in the session. As I said, I have 10 bills filed. Some of those are an opportunity to carry forward bills that I've filed in the past. A number of bills I've had, it'll take years. It may take 2 years. If I'm lucky, I can get a bill through in one, but usually it's probably more of a matter of 2, 3, 4 years. I have a bill filed that I've had in the past. It's designated wild areas in state forest. That would be to actually delineate certain areas in the state forest system that will be exempt from logging and commercial extraction. One of those areas the State Division of Forestry has seemed to be focusing on over the last year, and that's the Yellowwood and Morgan Monroe backcountry area. This is an area that was the subject of studies by scientists from many different universities that identified these areas as some of the most biodiverse areas in the Midwest and also within the country. And some of the trees average age of over 100 years, so 120 years. My point with this wilderness bill is to say that we have areas of the state that are, maybe they're not old growth, but they're starting to verge towards what we can consider old growth if we left them alone for another 100 years or so. The Division of Forestry has decided to set the clock back on those areas and extract timber. They will tell you it's single tree selection. They'll say it's very low intensive, but their version of single tree selection is averaging 6 to 8 trees per acre. So if anybody can think of what a one-acre lot, if you know anybody with a one-acre lot, and think of somebody extracting six large trees and try to say that's low-intensive, I think you'd say that they're at best misleading the public. Unfortunately, the governor is being misled as well. Hopefully we can help him see that there's reasons for protecting that. So that's Senate Bill 312. Along with that is a companion bill that requires the Division of Forestry to do a full cost-benefit analysis of logging in the state forest. So what is the cost of the state of putting in these gravel roads and frontage roads and skid areas? What's the cost of compaction of soil or loss of biodiversity? What's it going to take to extract invasives in the future? But part of that is, what is the impact of these logging trucks on local roads? So this would require that loggers have permits and bonding for impact to local roads. A logging truck can be 40 tons, and that's if it's loaded correctly, and a lot of times they're not. So if you think of these bridges that you see that may have a 5-ton capacity, 8-ton capacity, or local roads that they're rated for a matter of tons, and you can think if somebody's making $100,000 off a logging sale, but it costs them $1 million just to repair a bridge or a road, then obviously that's not in the state's best interest. Locally, we've dealt with the issue of food shaming or lunch shaming with students in our schools. So in Indiana, schools are allowed to have different methods for not serving meals to students who don't have enough money in their account. One, and some of those are just awful. So say if a child goes through the lunch line, they get a lunch, they get to the end, and they find out there's not enough money in their account, schools will make them throw their meal in the garbage. There are instances where schools will make the child work to make up the difference in what is owing in their account. So again, this isn't going back to the parents. It falls on the child and actually sets them apart. And you know how children can be. Obviously, that opens them up to ridicule and separation. So that's, I have a bill that would set up a framework within Indiana schools that is not allowed. It gives them some processes to try to collect on the money from the parent. And doesn't let that fall to the child to bear the brunt of that embarrassment. I have a bill, many charter schools fail. So we have charter schools that take over schools, and usually they're, you know, they're called not-for-profits, but usually they're a not-for-profit shell, and it's a for-profit company that gets the contract to operate the school. These schools will hire teachers that aren't accredited. They will pay low wages, and typically the students, they'll fail. So when a public school fails, there's a process for taking it over. When a charter school fails, we don't have anything similar. Not to mention that authorizers, the ones that actually authorize the school to operate, get a cut of the per student funding that comes from the state of 3%. So regardless of whether that school is failing, they still get that cut. So it's in their interest. It's kind of a scheme or a scam, would be more a better way to say it. And what my bill does is say that if a school is charter school is failing for 2 years, they're not allowed to take additional students. Right now they can continue to get additional students. And the authorizer is not able to collect from that student funding. And so if they're going to authorize it, they better do it out of the goodness of their own heart rather than just a way to make additional funds. We've had a summer study committee on confined feeding operations, which are very loosely regulated in the state. As a matter of fact, the state typically has their hands tied on how they can regulate CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations. Also, this would allow the state to have a more strict ability to regulate CAFOs or CAFOs that have caused problems. Also, it turns out that when manure is taken from CAFOs and spread on neighboring farm fields, that there's almost no setback to our waterways. Indiana has about 80% failure rate, impacted rate on our waterways and streams and lakes. A lot of that is E. coli and nutrients, and much of that does come from CAFOs spreading that manure without any real setback. So this would tighten that up. It would also say that when a CAFO is located, it has to be, right now the regulation says that the setback from a confined feeding operation, which can be huge, thousands of head of livestock, the setback can be measured to somebody's house. So that means this person's property is used as the setback for this private operation. And so this bill actually says any setback, both for notification and for setback of the facility, has to be to a property line. You cannot use somebody's property line to make up this setback area. Hopefully I'll be working with other legislators, even on the Republican side, that are interested in fixing this. It's a big problem in rural areas. Rural folks, even family farmers, say that they don't have a say in this, and it really has a big impact. I didn't see when I started.
Thank you. Is it time? Okay, yeah.
Okay, okay. Well, I'm halfway Great. Through those bills,
and I counted
be happy
six,
to talk
Mark.
About some of those.
I counted six. Okay, great. I want to thank you all for me at least, this has been really very enlightening, and you've given us a lot of additional information about your roles and so forth that I think is helpful. But it is now time, of course, for questions from the audience. Please go to the microphone, state your name, and ask your one-minute question.
Yes, good morning. My name is Pamela Davidson. I'm learning a lot. The solar bill that just passed, obviously done by public utilities to reduce competition. They've admitted it. Huge demand for solar investment, economic activity. Will that be looked at again? Because that's a regressive idea, the way the law was passed.
So on solar, it's interesting that the person who is the real driver behind that solar bill has now left and taken a job with a law firm out in D.C. So maybe that'll give you a little more hope that you could kind of reverse what happened there. But I think that the only two things that are likely to happen this session, it remains to be seen if they will, is I think there's some sympathy within the legislature, within the majority, for school systems that would like to install solar to reduce their utility costs and also be used as kind of a learning experience for the kids. But right now, the way the bill that was passed is written, they're limited to kind of a 15-year period on the net metering, and they need really 20 to kind of make the numbers work. So my understanding is that Representative Ober, the chairman of the House Utilities Committee, has introduced a bill that would deal with making it easier for schools to be able to do that. And then the solar advocates are saying that even if you keep the new structure, which I oppose, but even if you keep it, there's some technical things that need to be fixed because have to do with filing of rate tariffs and all that kind of stuff to make sure that if you install a solar system and 10 years from now you sell your house, that the next owner, the grandfathering agreement and the rates and things still apply to them. And that's really up in the air. So I think you might see some addressing of the schools and some of the technical issues. Whether or not you see the legislature change its mind and decide to do something different, that's a lot less likely, but you never know. There could be an amendment or something come up that would give people an opportunity to kind of rethink it.
Thanks. Anyone have anything to add on that?
My response to that is I'm ranking minority member on utilities, so we had to deal with the net metering bill when it was first introduced in the Senate. And rather than tackle that hurdle of taking back parts of that bill, there are some Republicans that are looking at fixing small parts of it, as Representative Pierce said. I'm focused more on renewable energy standards for the state. So this would require utilities to produce a graduated percentage of renewable or use a graduated percentage of renewable energy for their supply. And then there will also be some impacts if they don't. So this is making sure that our utilities aren't just focused on natural gas and fossil fuels, coal, that they're starting to have a plan in place to gradually improve the amount of renewable energies that's used to supply energy.
Good. Thanks. Okay, Bob?
Pamela, the only thing that I've heard, like what Representative Pierce said, dealing with schools and solar panels and so forth on that, but Representative Ober, who's in charge of chairman of the utilities, his office is next to mine, but I haven't had a chance to talk to him about his upcoming session and some of his key things he's going to be looking at, some issues. But we've got a couple more days next week as far as filing bills. But I don't know who the Senate handles that over there. But I think the only thing that might be addressed would deal with the schools and solar issues in dealing with them.
Okay. Any other comments? Peggy? Yeah.
In addition to the tweaks that need to happen because, you know, specific things have become apparent on the long term, I think that, yeah, absolutely, it could be brought up again. I think a lot of that has to do with how the technology develops. Batteries is the next big issue. So if that is developed quickly, then we will be readdressing this sooner. But if the battery industry doesn't develop as quickly as they hoped, then maybe we won't be, you know, reviewing it. But it absolutely is available for review at any time we think that it needs to be adjusted.
Yeah. Jeff?
And like I said last session, I'd be in favor if there's any changes we need to do, that I'm all ears and I will help make those changes if we have to.
You've been listening to a legislative update organized by the League of Women Voters of Bloomington-Monroe County. We heard one question today, but listen back next week to hear the rest of the community concerns expressed at the update.
Listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.